Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
As the year comes to a close, we were so very lucky to hear so many incredible stories this year on Grief Encounters. Looking back at all the episodes, it's actually quite overwhelming and such a beautiful thing that these people came in and shared these stories with us. So many of you have reached out and told us that this has helped in some small way, and that's exactly why we set this up. So we're going to have a look back at some of these episodes. The first clip that we're going to hear is from Kathleen Chayda, and it's definitely one of the most memorable conversations I've ever had. She describes the truly harrowing moment of hearing about the death of her two sons, Owen and Rory, by their father, Sanjeev, in 2013.
It would have been normal for them to have been with them. They'd have wondered why they were away overnight. I think that anyway. But other than that, I would have said there wasn't anything that they would have necessarily been concerned about at that stage. But even throughout that whole night and the next day, it was okay. He's going to be scared. He's going to be wondering. He's going to wonder, what can he do? Where can he go? Where can he turn? He's panicked. He's panicked because he's been found out. He's panicked because he's afraid I'm going to kick him out or whatever. But I always felt at that time that the worst that the boys would be would been scared. Him actually hurting them in any way until it was confirmed was not something I could have ever have imagined.
When did the news come through to you that what had happened? Because he crashed the car with the kids in the boot.
So throughout that morning, I suppose various things were happening. Guards were coming and going, and I had to give a statement. And it was, in hindsight now, when I think about it, we'd gone into the sunroom, which is just off the sitting room. It was a quiet little spot, and I was sat with one of the detectives, and I had my phone with me because there would have been various phone calls coming through. When he sat down and he started off with, so, Kathleen, you were born here in Ballinkillen. And I was like, oh my, how much of my life do you actually need to know? And it literally was from then all the way through to meeting Sanj and sort of our relationship, things like that. And that continued for, I have no idea sort of the time scale on it. But the next thing, the phone rang and it was a number that I didn't recognize. So I answered it again. Lots of numbers were coming through, the guards, various, etc. I answered it and it was Sanj on the other end of the line. And it was like, and you go into this strange phase. I've seen all the detective things on television where you go, you keep him talking. You keep him talking. So I'd made eye contact with the detective that was with me and it was like, okay, I needed to keep him talking here now. Where are you? What's happened? Where are the boys? And the first thing Sanj said to me was, there's been a crash. And he said, the boys are dead in the back, were the words. So he's the one that actually told me. Himself and I dropped the phone at that stage or handed it straight over to the detective. It's all a bit hazy, but I remember walking out, and everybody had realized that, because it's glass doors on the into the sitting room, and sort of anybody that was there, my parents and that, realized that something's going on. And so they were watching what was inside. And the next thing they see me just falling apart. So I walk back out into the sitting room, and I remember sitting down, and I remember, and I have no idea the time frame on this, but I remember sitting there staring, looking at the detective going, it can't be true. It can't be true.
This one really stands out in my mind. We were so lucky to meet the extraordinarily talented and beautifully sensitive Paul Harrington last January, who lost four members of his family from cancer since 2002. In the interview, he speaks about his incredibly close relationship with his sister, Siobhan, and the time that they shared together before she passed away.
I can't put a timeline on it. It could have been a year, 2 years after Siobhan died. And, you know, it's funny, I always remember sitting with her when she was dying, and she was asking me about singing songs at her funeral and stuff like that, and stuff like that. Isn't that funny how you say that? Mm. No, just singing songs at her funeral. And I remember, again, I had a terrible trauma at her funeral. She asked me to sing the song Vincent by Don McLean, about Vincent Van Gogh. And at the end of the song, this never happened to me before, I got in a loop on a line and I couldn't get out of it. And I was so upset about this, you know. And I said, God, and I was saying, I'll have to, I'll make that up to you sometime, you know. And she kind of said to me, she said, like, because she and I were thick as thieves, you know, growing up, I was the baby, and then she was the next up, there's 4 years between us. Mm. I always remember her dragging me around the place, dragging me around the house, you know. I mean, she didn't see her 50th birthday, 49 years of age. And she said to me, she said, you know, don't forget me. And I'm kind of saying, God, you know, how in the name of God could I forget you, you know? And some years later, I had this incredible dream. And because I would dream, even to this day, not as frequently, but to this day, you wake up thinking who's alive and who's dead in your family. And I, almost every day I would do a count. You'd wake up and say, who's here, who's... And sometimes you'd be dreaming about somebody who's gone. Mm. And it'd be so real. But this was the most real thing I think I've ever experienced in terms of a dream or a visitation, I suppose. And, you know, I remember seeing her. And I just was seeing her. She didn't speak. She'd long hair when she was kind of a teenager, into her 20s. Mm. She didn't have when she died. But this is how I saw her. And she had this kind of white ribbed kind of wool jumper, and everything was white, and she was just there. And I was kind of talking to her, she wasn't saying anything, and then I said, ah, and I kind of said, God, I was just reflecting on what she was like back in those days, and I said, ah, I get it. I said, you're happy now, I can see it. Mm. I can, you know, I can see it in your smile, I can see the whole thing now. I said, you've moved across, or you're in heaven, or whatever the term might be. But the thing was, she looked happy, content, at peace.
I sometimes wonder where you are.
4 or 5 years ago, I was sitting rehearsing for something completely different with my old Eurovision comrade, brother-in-arms, Charlie McGettigan, who, again, you know, he sadly lost his son, Shane, and that I'll never forget. I mean, so you can imagine him. I remember sitting with him on an aircraft, who were travelling, might have been 2 years after Shane had died, and I wanted to talk about it and talk about Shane to him in some way, shape or form. And I said, you don't mind me bringing this up, do you? And he said, mind, he said, that's all I think about, he says.
Those thoughts we used to share. And I know you're happy now. I see it in your face.
Because it's so easy for people who are not in the direct line of fire to assume that people have moved on a little bit.
We've been very lucky to keep in contact with this guest over Twitter over the last year, and he's been very supportive of what we do and us with him. We've had some incredibly inspirational guests on the podcast, and Stephen Teep is definitely one that's made a huge impression on us all and our listeners. Stephen's beautiful wife, Irene, passed away in 2017, and in the months following, it came out that they were one of the families to be affected by the cervical cancer scandal that claimed the lives of many Irish women during this period. Here he speaks about his decision to go searching for answers and accountability.
I get asked a lot, like, is when will this all stop? When will we get to an end of it? And to be honest with you, I don't know. Mm. I'm yet to go home after something, we've achieved something, and sit down on the couch, put the feet up and go, oh, that was a good day. Yeah. Part of this campaign. Every day I go home, my mind, my brain is just tuned in, okay, what's next? Mm. And I've been in this, I think a lot of people who have come across me since this whole scandal broke last April, think this fight only began last April. But this began in September 2015 when Irene was diagnosed with cervical cancer. I've been fighting every day since then. For 2 years it was with Irene by my side, and then she passed away. It's myself with the two boys. But this is, seems to be just the only frame of mind I have right now. And when will the end come? I honestly don't know. But as long as I can still be a father to Oscar and Noah, give them 100%. But I want to take them on this with me as well. They have to be able to see this as well, you know, to see exactly what such tragic events that happened to their mother had triggered, and show them, you know, look, you have to get up and do something, you know. When you're faced with two options, do something or do nothing. What are you going to pick? For me, I decided to do something, and it was based on them and to show them, so...
Addiction has been a topic that has come up in various forms over the past 12 months, and Niva Donoghue spoke to us about how we need to stop treating those with addiction problems in a dehumanizing way. Niamh produced an incredible podcast called The Gospel According to Matthew, where she sat down with her brother to discuss his own issues with addiction. Here she is speaking to Venetia and I about how it leads to such heartbreak.
Matthew had a very complex life 3 months before he passed away. He was doing incredibly well for about 6 months, and then he unfortunately went back down the drug using route, and nobody knew about it, and he was doing it in secrecy. And at that stage, the only option that my mom saw fit was to get him a one-way ticket to England so he could start a new life and be safe and be away from drugs, be away from debt, and just to try and give him a chance. And I'll never forget the morning that my mom sent him on the ferry, and I think she thought she'd never see him again. And for a while he did really well. He went through cold turkey again, as he had done many times previous. But unfortunately, addicts follow the drug, and he came back to Ireland and he got himself riddled with debt. He got himself involved with criminal activity and people who were anything but nice, and he told nobody. He hid it.
This person and I have, I would say, become friends since she was a guest on the podcast. Back in April, we were joined in studio by Jess Dornan-Linus to talk about the importance of storing memories and how it can aid and soothe a person's bereavement. In this clip, Jess also discusses the timeless nature of grief and how there are no set stages or timeframes in place that will be the same for everyone.
I mean, I've said it before, I know, it's not just I don't believe or I don't agree. There are not five stages of grief. If you go through 95 stages of grief, that's fine. That's completely. And stages makes it sound like there's a finish line. And I mean, I'm nearly 21 years on and there's no finish line. And in fact, I mean, it's taken me a long time to sort of actively deal or create something to help me deal with my grief. But it's because of that's the phase of life that I'm in. You know, I have children, my mum would have had grandchildren. I have been not stricken by grief, but really, really, you know, sideswiped, we've used that term already, but sideswiped by grief more often in the last decade than I have in the preceding decade, because I see so much. Yeah, and because I see what she, you know, would have loved to see. And, you know, because my 20s, you mean, your 20s are your 20s, and I just went off. I probably didn't really deal with it properly. I went to university. It was all quite hedonistic. And then I was talking about this with my great friend, Fiona, and I kind of went through my entire life story with her recently. And I seem to have needed a complete change in my life every so often. So, you know, I did a degree in fashion design, and then I worked in fashion for a few years here in Dublin, and then I just needed out of Ireland. I needed out of a relationship at the time, and I moved to South Africa. I trained to be a field guide, and I worked with lions for a year and lived in a caravan with no electricity. I mean, that is really going.
Yeah, it's called escape.
Escapism, exactly. Yeah,
it is.
Or a change is as good as a rest.
Or it could be just some day in the morning at work, just going, I need to do something.
I need to change.
I don't know what
situation.
It is. I need to do something, whether it's exciting or different, or just something.
And it's that activity. I've heard a lot from you know, experts in grief, like counsellors and that sort of thing, saying, you know, you have to be active in your grief. And we've talked about lots of times, you know, actively creating a memory book. And well, everything needs digitally supported. So this is the digital support.
during the Dublin Pride Festival, Venetia was really fortunate to speak with Tony Walsh, and I'm really, really bummed I missed out on this one, who is one of the most instrumental gay rights activists the country has ever seen. Tony spoke to us about the AIDS crisis during the 80s and 90s and the stigma, guilt and grief that has stuck with much of the community ever since.
I lived through the AIDS crisis and watched countless friends and lovers die. I mean, the last time I counted, and that was several years ago, it shaded 40 people in London and Dublin. And while that was happening, I always thought, no matter how much I'm attempting to use safer sex, I'm going to be next on the list. And then you find you survive. But here's the thing, it gets even more complicated then, because I become positive 10 years after the advent of antiretroviral therapies. In 2005, I was raped, and I'd spent a lifetime using condoms, only to find myself then 10 years later becoming HIV positive at a time when it's simply a long-term illness, long-term condition, and I can live a normal life. And that added a whole other layer of guilt.
Yeah. We laughed and cried our way through the next interview as the Times writer and podcaster Emily Dean joined us for one of our London sessions. We almost didn't get there, but here we are to talk about the unexpected side effects that come with grief and how it is often conducive to creating rifts and drama within families.
How long was it between losing your sister that you lost your parents?
And my parents. Yeah, it's interesting. I call it whack-a-mole, because you're sort of, you know, it's that fairground game where you're thinking, oh, I'm just dealing with that. Oh, no, another thing's popping up. And it's impossible to sort of keep tabs on all those emotions that... And I, so after my sister died, and another thing that I didn't realise was quite, I thought it was like movies where we'd all cry and everyone would be very, there'd be all this warmth and there'd be no complications. And of course,
it's a hard thing to
navigate.
We
all know it's not like that. And it brings up strange things. Families' dynamics get destroyed. And I, it's like a rock being lifted up and suddenly everyone's role has changed. And I don't know if that's something you guys experienced.
We actually literally talked about that as well on the plane, the whole, I think, I mean, like, I've experienced people who just can't be in the house, mainly male friends, because they just, you know, it's just they're in, out, just can't. Other people sort of just don't want to talk about it. Other people want to talk about it all the time. You know, and I just think people, and one thing we've discovered with this podcast is everybody grieves so totally differently.
Yeah.
And whereas I was initially would get angry with somebody not grieving the way I thought they should be grieving, now I realise that you've got to let people grieve the way they grieve. Yeah. And that's how they do it. And not just because you're the person who's lost someone, because they have too.
Yeah. Mm. Yes, exactly. And you know, do... Sorry, were you going to say something?
No, I was just going to say, I think that what you said is so true. Like, I was completely in the same boat where I thought it was going to be about crying. I thought it was going to be about sadness. I thought maybe it would be about depression. But I didn't think it was going to be about anger and family rifts and battles about things you didn't even understand and drawing lines in the set. And, like, all of those things just shocked me that that was part of it, because it felt like things are already so hard. Why are we engaging in this? But actually, now I see it so much as part of grief, that everyone is struggling, and that's a natural part of that struggle.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
We've made a lot of friends in recording the podcast over the past year, and Megan Devine is definitely on that list. I feel very, very lucky that Megan is in my life. Even our chats on Instagram on an almost daily basis have been a really cathartic and wonderful experience. Megan is an incredible writer and grief advocate based in Portland, and her book, It's Okay That You're Not Okay, is an incredible resource for those at any point in their grief. Here she breaks down some of the common misconceptions around how we feel after the loss of a loved one.
I think you bring up another good point, too. Can we just touch on it for a second?
Yeah, of course.
You said you didn't feel anything for the first couple of months. Sometimes people are like, what is going on? I should have more feelings here. I should be really sad. Like, humans are complex creatures, and you've never had to live without your mom before.
Yeah.
This was the first and only time your mom died. We have no idea how you're going to respond to that. However you respond is how you respond, right? I think we do that relentless self-inquiry, self-interrogation. What's wrong with me? Because we've internalized the cultural messages about grief, too, that it's supposed to look a certain way and last a certain amount of time. You're supposed to cry, rend your garments, be a little bit morose and weepy, but not too much, for a certain amount of time, and then be done. And if you don't do that, well, then you're in denial, right? Whether we tell ourselves that or people around us tell us that. Like, there are so many ways that that faulty understanding of the reality of grief affects and infects everybody. This is why it's so important to tell the truth about this stuff, so that grieving people understand that however they respond to the loss of someone they love is okay. And so that support people, both professional and personal, have more understanding and more compassion and more really useful skills with how to respond to such things, instead of just flailing around making things worse.
There have been many surprises along the way when recording the podcast this year, but none more so than the amount of laughter that Venetia and I would share with our guests. A.B. Philbin Bowman joined us in September to tell us about his relationship with his brother Jonathan, and this chat featured so many incredible anecdotes that summed up just how special he was.
I remember him sending, like, Albert Reynolds, who was a Taoiseach at the time, to a Tina Turner concert, because he knew Albert was a big Tina Turner fan. And he also knew that they had tickets to give away, and they went, let's just give them to the Taoiseach and see if he'll, like, review the concert for us.
But it's so brilliant. Like, yeah. That is such a brilliant thing to do.
So he had these kind of really mischievous ideas. I remember he had a skit once where he phoned up a cleaning company, and he was basically pretending to be a mobster who just really needed very discreet cleaners who would, like, clean everything up, but, like, could keep a secret. And he was sort of letting on hints that this is what was going on. And the person on the phone was getting gradually more and more uncomfortable. And he was just full of, like, really crazy fun ideas. And he was, as you say, a bit of a force of nature. But he also loved winding people up. Like, at home, it used to drive me mad. He would sometimes take a position that he didn't even agree with himself, just because he enjoyed arguing so much that he would like to kind of win at the family dinner table.
I felt like it was a really special day when I got to do this episode. Since starting the podcast, we've had the opportunity to learn about the lives of some truly incredible people that have touched Ireland and beyond in so many ways. I spoke to Don Morgan about his father, Dermot, back in October, and he regaled us with so many amazing stories about what he was like off screen and who the real Dermot Morgan really was. There's so much effort that goes into pretending, and, like, physical and mental, emotional effort into, like, protecting people from it, especially probably, I can imagine, and maybe I'm wrong, and definitely please, you know, like, I would imagine you guys had to be protective of the grief because so many people were mourning him. But it was your grief, and it was your father, and it was your family, which is a very different thing than this person who was this icon in Ireland, who meant so much, and not just Ireland, but beyond, who meant so much to so many people. But it was your loss.
Yeah, I mean, I think that you sort of have to put all the different people into different kind of boxes. And I mean, he was no different to a lot of other people, which is the fact that he had different personas. He was a dad, he was a brother, he was a friend, he was someone on the telly. You know, I mean, at that time, I mean, I remember when I was a teacher, for instance, I was teaching at school in Messiah, and it was a lovely class. But they all had iPads and were Googling me. And then after a while, they said, are you Father Ted's son? And I was going, oh, yeah, yes, I am. And I've been, at this age, I'd learned, you know, don't get defensive, enjoy it. They think it's brilliant.
Yeah,
they think it's absolutely fantastic. But I mean, I know that the idea of you know, who are you grieving? I mean, certainly when I think about my dad, I don't grieve for the actor necessarily. I grieve to a certain extent for the loss of opportunity, and I grieve to a certain extent about the fact that, as amazing as Father Ted is, I wish that he could have been remembered for his other work. But that's not taking away from that. It's obviously a fantastic show, and you know, he's one of the immortals.
I know. I saw when you described that. I thought that was like so fitting. Just one of the immortals. I think that's just incredible. The other thing I really wanted to ask you about, and because I've been through it myself. My daughter was born after both my parents had died. I love to imagine what they would have been like with their grandchildren, and I love to think about it. But I, at the same time, I find it very, very hard to imagine something like that. One of the highlights of the year was undoubtedly our live show at the Dublin premiere of Git Was Here, a Lorcan Fox movie about the life and legacy of his friend Chris Byrne. We were incredibly nervous, but we did it, and we were joined on stage at the Sugar Club by Lorcan and Chris's wife, Caroline, to learn more about his life and the final few months before he died.
For anyone who walks down the south wall quite a bit, down to the lighthouse, it's lovely to put the mural in context. What's it like, though, watching the documentary and seeing it come to life again and seeing his personality, particularly previous to when he got sick?
I was mentioning it to you there before the interview. It took me a long time to remember the healthy Chris, especially throughout his period of being unwell and what the chemotherapy and the radiotherapy and the treatment did to him, what the surgery did to him. So I suppose it's only in the last 6 months I started to remember the Chris that I, as I said in the documentary, the Chris that I fell in love with. So I'd kind of eliminated the sick Chris from my head until I saw the documentary last Tuesday week, and I remember I mentioned it to Lorcan. It's quite difficult. I suppose towards the very end there, you saw photographs of Chris holding his nephew, Josh, who's his sister's baby boy. And I'd forgotten that Chris. And it's Christmas 2015, Chris came to Clare. It was his last Christmas. I remember looking at him that Christmas and going, geez, this fella's not going anywhere anytime soon. And he passed away 3 months later. But that's how much I was in denial with his illness and his sickness, even though Jodie and I had met his oncologist probably 2 weeks before Christmas and told us that there was a limited amount of time left. But I think we were just in denial. We were just constantly living in hope that...
So you sort of need to keep moving forward when somebody so close to you is that sick. Is that sort of
you
almost...
You just can't give up.
Yeah.
And that Christmas passed, and I remember we were due to go to Ringsend for New Year's Day for dinner down to Chris's parents' house, Jodie and Edel. And Chris had a fall on New Year's morning, and I remember having to get a neighbour of ours in Lucan to come and assist. But Jodie and Edel, with the help of... Jimmy and Eileen, they brought the whole dinner out on New Year's evening. We were sitting around the table that evening, and Chris announced that evening that he wasn't going having any more treatment. So he said that he felt that the treatment wasn't working and he was going to discontinue it. I suppose at that stage he realised that it wasn't doing any more for him. And he realised he was probably looking at end of life as well. It was probably hard for us to swallow as his partner and his wife and his parents, even though we had been told probably 3 weeks previous to that that the treatment wasn't going to do anything more for him other than help his mind.
Just this month, Venetia and I sat in with Sean Kennedy, who is a writer and performer, and he shared with us the most personal and heartbreaking story of his life. Sean spent 9 weeks in Australia caring for his terminally ill mother, who was suffering abuse at the hands of an ex-partner. I think this is probably one of the most genuine, beautiful, and incredible stories I've ever heard. And here Sean speaks about his mother's final few days.
Just to answer your earlier question about it happening, that she'd met this man very similar to my father in a lot of ways. She said this thing to me. She was like, why did I always go for the bird with the broken wing? You know, she said, I just wanted to love him and I wanted to see the good in him. And every time he did something, I just wanted to see that he was capable of love. And he just took advantage of me over and over and over again.
What did it mean to you, Sean, that she was able to reach this point before she died, and you were there with her?
It was really sad because I felt like it was mixed, because I wanted to have had this with her so much sooner, you know. I wanted to have spent more of my life with her, and it was all very intense because I didn't know how close she was to the end at that point.
We really want to thank all of our guests for being so generous with their time and their stories this year. You've truly helped so many people. You've helped us, and we hope in some way it's helped you too. We look forward to hearing more stories of love next year.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.